name is Corey.
And I'm Katie King.
And this is True Crime New England. What's up, everybody?
Hello. Welcome back to another episode.
Thank you for joining us on what is arguably one of the most crazy, ping-pongy, back-and-forth episodes we've ever done.
Yes. And as you can tell by the title, it is the murders of two individuals. But in order for us to tell you the story of those murders, we have to tell you about a lot of other crimes and people and perpetrators. And it definitely is an episode where I would say break out the bulletin board and the red string.
Oh, yeah. Because it's definitely a picture of that meme of that guy who's confused.
He's got the crazy eyes.
Yes. And he's like, you can tell he's saying like, no, 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 listen to me. Guys, I'm not crazy. Because that's what this kind of sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
And I do like when we cover cases where we have to explain another case to kind of get to the case we're covering. Like in the sense that it's more interesting and more, I don't know, extensive. There's a lot of ground to cover in this case, and I was actually really fascinated by the different aspects of this case because it involves drugs, it involves attempted murder, it involves successful murder, it involves witness tampering, witness protection. It is a lot of stuff. And we've covered cases kind of similar to this ilk before, and not super long ago even, really. It kind of reminds me a little bit of our recent episode, the murder of Jennifer Rivera, a young woman who was murdered as a result of being a star witness against somebody in another murder case. This is very similar.
Yeah, definitely.
Very similar. And it kind of just goes to show you how dangerous being a witness is. And sometimes it's not even like it's not even your fault that you're a witness. You're just there.
Right. You happen to have eyes and be in the same place. Like,
right.
It's crazy. Yeah. And one of the victims of the case is very, very young. And Jennifer Rivera was also very, very young. I mean, she was, what, 15 at the time of her murder?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So this is very reminiscent of that. And we honestly are just glad that we can do a full episode on this, because mm-hmm. this was one that we were thinking, shit, we might have to do like a case profile, mini episode situation.
Mm-hmm.
But we actually ended up having quite a lot of information, which tends to be a rarity with cases of people of color, as we know. So we are just thankful that we are able to do a full episode and like really talk about it in depth.
Oh, yeah. And even though this case is solved, thankfully, and we do obviously cover case profiles that are solved, but you're right, Katie, like we almost were like, no, case profile, but I'm glad we can do this as a full episode, because when you get into it and really dig into each individual moving part, it's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It is a lot. And you have to figure there's a lot of different lives here that we're really fucked with, essentially. We're going to be talking about the murders of these two people in the title, but there is also another murder on top of that. So that kind of led to this point. And it's just, it's a lot. It really is. And this happens a lot more often than you'd think. And it's disgusting.
For sure.
Drugs really get people fucked up. Not just getting high fucked up, but I mean, like, it will ruin your life in so many different ways. So many different ways. And the people around you. Because unfortunately, the people in the title were not doing drugs and they still were killed. It's just a lot of tragedy to go around here. So I think it's important that everyone sticks around and listens, because this will be nothing if not informational.
Mm-hmm.
And without further ado, today we will be covering the murders of Leroy Brown Jr. and Karen Clark. Katie, sometimes I'm kept up at night because I wonder, will today be the day she doesn't give me her sources? But then I think to myself, that would just be absurd. Because, and I'm scared to ask you this just because of these nightmares I have, but will you give me your sources for today's case?
Liz, pinch me, I'm dreaming. I'd love to give you my sources for today.
Thank you.
You're so welcome.
I can rest again.
We'll sleep good tonight.
Oh, yes, I will.
I have information from our friends over at Murderpedia, The Register Citizen, News Times, Cape Cod Times, New Haven Register, Fox 61, and CT Insider.
Well, Katie, I'm going to tell you right now, there's a reason why we were having such different information as we were going through this prior to recording, because we had a lot of different sources.
Wow, okay.
Which is great. I, of course, too, had Murderpedia. That is a no-brainer, hands down, that's the one. I used the New York Times, I used La Justia, I used Connecticut Post, and I used Find Law.
Nuh-uh.
Dead serious. Of course.
Wow!
I actually used, technically speaking, like, 3 law documents, because Murderpedia had also posted a law document as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I was reading a lot of words that were big and lawful, but I felt like I was well informed.
Sweet deal.
And it sounds like with all the sources you had, you were also well informed.
I really like when this happens, because I get to learn about information that you have that I didn't see, and then I can tell you information that you might not have come across.
Yes, absolutely.
And this just goes to show, you know, we get comments sometimes, you guys, and we'll get into the case, like, real quick, I promise, but we get comments from people who love to be like, oh, you guys are faking it with all the oohs and the ahs and the wows and the questions and the oh shit. This is part of why we give our sources, like, one, because we cite our sources, like, that's been ingrained into us since
birth.
Pretty
much.
And two, because, like, we have, sometimes we have such different information that, like, we will come across things that the other did not even see or read about.
Yeah.
Which I think makes for a better episode, in my humble opinion.
But, of course, we do not research together. We do it all on our own. So I agree with you. In my also humble opinion, I agree. So yeah, everyone, let's get started. Katie, would you?
Sure thing.
Awesome.
Russell Peeler Jr. and his younger brother Adrian were the sons of Sheila Peeler, who was a police officer. Now, Sheila was law-abiding, really passionate about her job, and she was constantly telling her boys to do good, to not get into trouble or fall into a pattern of violence and crime like so many kids their age and so many people that she saw as a police officer that were just in their area. That's kind of how the area was.
Mm.
Russell started off as a good kid, but then he got to Central High School and he fell into the wrong crowd and quickly became known as a troublemaker and a problem student at the school. He was constantly instigating other kids. He was the type of kid who would saunter down the hallway and shove somebody else into a locker for no reason.
Oh, God.
A bully and a dick.
Yeah.
He somehow, like, he's getting into fights in the schoolyard and, like, probably shoving people into their lunch trays in the cafeteria. Like, he was an ass.
Yeah.
But he also somehow managed to get borderline grades. And so his mom, as kind of a last-ditch effort, she was like, you need to get your shit together and you need to enroll at the Housatonic Community College in their criminal justice program.
Mm.
Like, get your shit together. Take after me.
Yeah.
You know, you want a life of crime. How about you learn about crime since you're so interested in it?
Fair enough.
But his academic career didn't last long, no surprise. Mm. And in the late 1980s, he joined the Bush Mob, who were an absolutely terrifying drug gang.
Mm.
Not affiliated with the actual mob, who are not terrifying and who we are not at all scared of.
No, we love the mob. Everybody who listens to us regularly knows that we heart the mob. They are our good, loyal people. And they have no affiliation with this aforementioned Bush Mob. Thank you.
Frankly, it's an insult to the mob themselves, but
quite honestly,
to each their own. Russell worked his way into this gang and asserted himself as part of them by dating the daughter of one of the gang's head leaders, 14-year-old Angelina Keen Bush. I would like to point out that he was 18 years old at this time.
Yuck.
In early December of 1993, Sheila Peeler was now dying of stomach cancer, and on her deathbed, she asked her two boys, Russell and Adrian, to use the money from her life savings and mostly her life insurance to put towards college, go to school, like one last
do good
plea.
Yeah.
To turn their life around. That's all she's been telling them their whole life. And now she's like, I'm on my literal deathbed. I'm leaving you this money for my life insurance. Can you please just use it to turn your life around? And Russell refused. And instead of using that money that his now deceased mother left him, he took the total of $50,000 and started his own drug ring.
It's one of these situations where, well, A, this woman sounded like a wonderful, devoted mother who really tried to get her sons on the right path. Truly. And it's really moments and people like this where I hope that she is up there looking down and can see how fucking awful. And like, I hope her sons know how disappointed. Like, I hope they feel guilty. I hope they are guilty. And like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I hope they live with this guilt every day.
100%.
And like, have this feeling that she's watching them like disappointed as hell.
Rolling in her grave.
Absolutely. Because how dare they?
Mm-hmm. So Russell's drug ring grew eventually. And, you know, other dealers in the area started paying attention. And, you know, he started getting more affiliates, as I kept seeing them mentioned, like employees, affiliates. Sure. And, you know, everybody has their own kind of job. And it's mainly crack cocaine.
Sure.
People are bringing in the dry cocaine. People are cooking it up and getting the ingredients and stirring it. And
however you make crack cocaine.
Yeah.
It's not something we are familiar with.
No. But it seemed like everybody had their own little role. It was like an assembly line. Like,
oh, yeah.
Literally. Everybody did their own thing. And they were running like a Swiss watch at its peak. It really blew up. And he became a drug lord.
Yeah.
And he soon started working with a man named Rudolph Sneed Jr. Very Dr. Seuss-esque name, but
yeah.
Who among us?
Rudy Sneed.
And the two formed really a partnership, but kind of like an alliance. Like, they worked together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you need to have your associates when you're running a crack cocaine illicit drug business. And, you know, the thing is, you got to have people that you trust, because one bad egg and you're going down and the whole thing is going down. So Rudolph, who went by Rudy Sneed, he provided the brothers with powdered cocaine, which was then turned into crack cocaine. Followed by then, of course, being sold on the streets, which I honestly did not know that powdered cocaine cooked crack cocaine. I didn't put it together. But that was Rudy's job. He sold the cocaine to the boys, got money, et cetera, et cetera. So it didn't seem like these guys were in a partnership for super long, because Rudy was accused by Russell of overcharging for the powdered cocaine. I don't know how much powdered cocaine runs usually, and I don't know if there's a specific like exchange rate for cocaine being sold for the purpose of crack cocaine. Like, I don't know how good it's for or whatever, but Russell was like, you are overcharging me for this much, whatever. And Rudy was like, how dare you? Except he wasn't like, how dare you? Instead, he kind of overreacted a little bit, I would say, a little bit. And he may have shot up the crack house. Just maybe. As far as I could tell, nobody was injured. But it was kind of like a fuck you for accusing me of overcharging you. And thus, the partnership ended.
There had been some tension leading up to this. there was, you know, accusations of course, like, you're overcharging me, you're keeping this money for yourself, we're not splitting the profits as we had previously discussed. And then there were also a couple instances where Rudy embarrassed or humiliated Russell, and Russell, being the pussy ass bitch that he is, got all offended and butthurt and was like, how dare you? My ego, oh, no, 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 these are my associates and you're making me look bad in front of them. And so there's a lot of tension, and then it just kind of ended with Rudy shooting up the crack house.
Pretty much. And obviously, this would cause somebody who was a little sensitive, like Russell, to want to retaliate. And so that was kind of what he did. So, on September 2nd, 1997, Russell was in the car with several associates, as you call them, business partners, co-workers, maybe, who also, of course, worked with him in this crack cocaine operation, and they were driving through Bridgeport, Connecticut, when they saw Rudy's car outside of a barbershop. And this was perfect. They were going to jump into action and retaliate right then and there. Because you already know they had guns on them at all times. They were staying strapped. No big deal. So Russell and his associates stopped, and they watched as Rudy left the barbershop and got in his car and proceeded to drive away. Now, the members of the operation, including Russell, also did notice that in the back of Rudy's car were two young boys. Okay, that did not, like, it probably mattered to them as much as noticing his car had four tires. Like, it was just a fact. There was two young boys in the back of his car. So, ignoring, you know, any factors that may prevent someone from retaliating in that moment, Russell and his buddies followed Rudy's car to the entrance ramp to Route 25, where as soon as he started to go up the ramp, Rudy slowed down and pulled to the side. I'm thinking he probably noticed Russell's car, because he obviously knew who Russell was in his car, and he probably was like, excuse me, like, I know who you, like, why are you following me? And so, seeing this as the perfect opportunity, Russell and his buddies pulled right up next to Rudy's car, and using a .40 caliber semi-automatic handgun, Russell fired his gun until it jammed before speeding off. So he's in the passenger side of the, you know, the front of the vehicle, and he's shooting his gun into the front of Rudy's car just as much as he can. It jams, and then they drive off. I bet you Russell thought he totally annihilated this guy. And several of these gunshots did hit Rudy, but not fatally. He was wounded, but he was actually able to drive away. And as he did so, glass from his shattered windows were like falling onto the highway. And a Bridgeport police officer noticed this and pulled him over because it was like, sir, your windows are a little broken. And also, like, you're spreading glass on the highway. And when he pulled him over, he saw Rudy was bleeding. I believe it said he had a forehead wound, like he'd been grazed or something. Like, he was okay. He did survive this attempt, but he was injured. And so the police officer was like, holy shit, like, are you okay? You need to go to the hospital. And so he was sent to St. Vincent's Medical Center, which was nearby, to get treatment. And at the hospital, and like while waiting for the ambulance, whatever, Rudy was explaining to this police officer what happened. And this police officer was taking down statements, and because, you know, they're thorough and this was something crazy that happened, the police officer obviously, of course, noticed that there was those two young boys in the backseat of the car. One of them was Rudy's young son, Tyrell Sneed, and the son of his girlfriend, 7-year-old Leroy Brown Jr., who went by BJ. Luckily, by the grace of God, neither of those boys were injured physically. They witnessed this, but they were completely fine. Maybe some glass injured them a little bit, but they were not treated at all in the hospital. They were totally fine, which is amazing.
That is some miracle right there. That is some miracle. And you know, not every drug dealer on the street is like a bad, nefarious, evil guy.
No,
you know,
I'd say most aren't.
Agreed. I think that there's a lot of people behind bars currently who should not be, who all they were doing is selling some weed.
100%.
Selling some coke.
Yep.
We can get into that another time.
Yeah.
Russell, as we have already established, is just a horrible person,
yes.
A bully, an evil person, and he's a drug lord. You really are not a good person if you're someone who can be a drug lord. Drug dealer, totally different than a drug lord.
Oh,
okay?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And all of that aside, if you see with your own two eyes that there are two young children, I bet you he recognized that Tyrell was Rudy's son.
Oh, yeah.
I bet you that wasn't the first time he'd seen him.
No way.
Number one. But you know that you're going to shoot at Rudy. Can't you pick another time, dude?
Right.
Maybe follow him, watch him drop off the boys, and then try. Like, ugh.
Right. 100%. I'm with you. If I was a drug lord, I would do the same. I mean, it's the children. It's something about having children involved that makes it seem so much fucking worse because the children are vulnerable.
It's so uncalled. These kids are not shorting you on cocaine money. Like,
no. What? They're literally probably, like, it was in the nighttime. They probably were, like, snoozing in the back. Like, who the fuck cares?
Crazy. Crazy.
Ugh.
By some miracle, those kids were physically unharmed.
Right? So miraculous. And of course, thanks to Rudy knowing who shot him, he was able to give the police Russell's name. And maybe he didn't want to, given, you know, the implications, or maybe it didn't matter, but either way, Russell was now wanted for attempted murder. And shortly following Rudy's attempted murder, Russell Peeler was arrested on a charge of the attempted murder of Rudolph Sneed. And I don't know exactly why this was an option. But Russell was actually up for bail. I don't know exactly why this was an option. But Russell was actually up for bail. And he did end up posting it. And he subsequently was released from custody until his trial date. Which also kind of blows my mind a little bit. When Russell returned to his buddies, he wasted no time in telling them, hey, we are going to get this fucker and end him for sending me to jail. And at first, Russell, he threatened Rudy. And unfortunately, Rudy did not give him the response back that Russell really wanted to elicit. So he was like, no, screw it, we're going to kill this guy. And thus, a plan of retaliation, aka murder, was put into place by Russell.
On May 29th, 1998, Russell threw a denim jacket over his head to conceal his face and walked into a barbershop on Boston Avenue in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Rudolph was sitting in the back, just hanging out, and Russell approached him and shot him multiple times. In one article I read, it said that he pumped him full of bullets.
Whew.
So I don't know what it is with this barbershop, because it seems like Rudy hangs out there a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Part of me is thinking that maybe he hangs out in the back and sells drugs out of there.
Possibly.
Or, like, just hangs out there sometimes.
Maybe he works there.
Maybe he worked there. Maybe his girlfriend worked there.
Never clear, really.
Maybe he was just late getting his hair cut and was waiting to get a hair. I don't know. But that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, when police learn that a man, walked into a barbershop right up to Rudy and shot him at close range multiple times, there really was only one person on their mind who could have done this, and that was Russell.
Yeah.
And the police are realizing, oh shit, Rudy was like the witness to the attempted murder on himself,
mm-hmm,
that Russell did. Who else saw that? The two boys.
Yeah.
And Karen Clark, who was BJ Brown's mother and dating Rudy, when she heard about this, that her son was in the back seat of the car that was shot up in a drive-by shooting,
mm-hmm,
she brought her kid down and she's like, BJ, tell them what you saw.
Yeah.
Like, my kid could have been killed. Mm-hmm. We need to get this guy off the street.
Mm-hmm.
And so BJ picked Russell, who was 27 at this point,
mm-hmm,
out of a lineup and positively identified him. And this was not lost on Russell.
Right. Absolutely. So now Rudy was dead. Russell was being implicated in this murder thanks to BJ's identification. The ballistics done on the bullets at the scene of both crimes revealed they were discharged from the same weapon. Obviously, this implicated him even more. And so Russell, like you said, he was arrested with the murder charge, finally, as went from attempted murder to, well, completed murder. Now, I don't know how this is possible, but Russell was offered bail again, and he was able to post it again. I'm imagining because crack cocaine pays well, but he was let go, given a curfew and had an ankle monitor, whatever, but he was now more free than in prison, so he was technically winning, realistically, and he was now, like, out on the streets again, and he could really still run his crack cocaine business, no problem. But so now, he's this mostly free guy, waiting trial, and, you know, he has a right to lawyers and pretrial evidence and preparing for a trial, and he knows he's been identified, and he knows that, well, Rudy's dead. Who else could have identified him? And that's where he kind of gets in his brain, oh, it's that kid. He knows who Tyrell is, Rudy's son, and he kind of has a theory about who the other kid was. And it's confirmed later on when he sees BJ in his yard playing, and BJ sees him, gets a look of absolute terror on his face, and runs away. That confirms it for him, and he then knows for 100% certain that's the kid. Now, let's talk a little bit about Leroy, aka BJ Brown Jr., and his mom, Karen Clark, because they are the best. Always, right? That's all. The people who are always murdered in these stories are the cutest, best, always. BJ Brown was described truly as one of the most joyful and fun little boys you could play with at the Boys and Girls Club of Bridgeport. He was a leader, he was athletic, and he loved to swim and wrestle. He was always known to be neatly dressed, but he was also quick to be the class clown, which I respect. He was also very sweet and charming, although only 7 at the time, he did ask a girl in his class that if, when they were 10, she would consider going on a date with him, which made me chuckle.
Oh my God.
Isn't that sweet? I loved it. BJ was also a mama's boy, and rightfully so, because his mother, Karen Clark, she loved her son more than anything. It was them two against the world. She'd chaperone field trips, brought her son to school every day, and then personally, of course, dropped him off to the Boys and Girls Club without fail. She was described as energetic and involved. She was born in Jamaica and came to the U.S. just before high school, where she settled in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. She went to school for a short time to become a medical administrative assistant and then went to live with her cousin in New York, where she ended up meeting BJ's father and having BJ. From there, Karen, her cousin, and BJ all moved to Bridgeport, where she took classes at a nearby community college before landing a job at the U-Haul Moving Center. She did great here. She eventually was promoted to the state headquarters in Orange, working as a coordinator of equipment traffic. And that's where she was working at the time of this incident. So she had, like, worked her way up, which is awesome. So BJ's father was unfortunately not around much, but that didn't mean there was any shortage of love for this young boy. Karen had been dating Rudolph Sneed Jr., Rudy, and BJ loved him. He referred to him as dad and was just very fond of him. And that's why part of this is so heartbreaking, because BJ, I mean, A, witnessed the attempted murder on him, and then, of course, he was eventually murdered, and that's terrible. After BJ was involved in this incident, you know, where the car was shot, his life was changed forever. He became noticeably haunted and paranoid, and per his mother's advice, he would not go outside when at the Boys and Girls Club after school. He would often be found at his after-school activity acting very glum, if not crying with his head down. It was very haunting for him.
Oh,
I know.
that's like classic PTSD too. Oh my God.
At this point, he was about 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
The boy who once would be so rambunctious and flirty with all his little lady friends was now broody, scared, and suffering from flashbacks. And Karen shared this paranoia as well. She was often seen crying when she would drop her son off at the Boys and Girls Club and school, and she knew her son was in danger, and she probably had a feeling she was too. While Rudy was extremely helpful in implicating Russell, obviously, for his attempted murder, so was BJ, so much so to the fact that the whole police department in Bridgeport knew BJ. He had given a great witness statement to the attempted murder that was so powerful that he got a lot of respect from everyone. Bridgeport Police Chief Thomas Sweeney is quoted as saying he had an impressive ability to recall and reconstruct events better than some older people, which I think is very impressive. He probably had a good future. Like, he could have been like law enforcement.
A sharp kid. And the pictures, both of them. Karen is so beautiful. I found a really nice portrait of her.
Yeah.
And then Leroy, I found his, I think it was his school photo.
Yeah.
The cutest little child. Oh my God.
Munchkin. And all the police officers at the station described him sweet and well-spoken and, of course, very brave, because being a witness in an attempted murder and then technically now a murder takes a lot of guts. And he knew he was putting his life in danger at 8 years old, as you can tell. In the summer after Rudy was killed, Karen and BJ moved. They didn't move very far, just across town, pretty much, but it was done in part to, quote, get away from all that mess, according to Karen. Once the mother and son duo moved, they had a police detail posted outside their new house for just about a week. They were also followed by an officer when they went out of town. Not long after this, though, Karen asked the police to stop with the protection because she felt it brought way too much attention to her and BJ instead of helping them, which, you know, they wanted to be more anonymous, but it was really just kind of pointing more lights at them, saying like, here, 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 which I think is fair, but also, you know, like at the same time, it's like you take the protection away. It's such a double-edged sword in that regard.
For sure. And it was probably freaking out BJ too. Like, he's already scared. He's already on edge. How do you, as an 8-year-old, process what you had to witness and this level of responsibility that's on your shoulders?
Yeah.
I mean, this poor kid was like a shell of a child at that point.
Yes.
And now there's cops constantly patrolling around his home. He can't even go outside and play and be a kid.
He doesn't even want to.
Right.
Right? Because he's just so scared.
He's terrified.
And what is so scary is that, and Karen doesn't even know this, she moves her house. She doesn't want to be near all this mess, right? She wants to be safe. But what she doesn't know is that Russell's moved his crack house to right across the street, the same road, Earl Avenue. And I just can't. I don't know if that was 100% intentional, but I have a sneaking suspicion it was.
Right. And let's be real. He's a drug lord. He can probably purchase whatever house he wants.
Mm-hmm. If he can post bail for attempted murder and then murder, I think he could do whatever he wants. Right.
So Russell had told his underage girlfriend, Angelina, who, as we know, she was 14 and he was 18 when they started dating, that he was going to, quote, start killing witnesses. Obviously, Rudy, no longer with us, main witness. This pretty much left BJ.
Mm-hmm.
And Russell, now it really was no secret as to where BJ lived. He had full access. He could probably open up the curtains or look through the blinds and see what was going on over in the Clark Brown household.
Yep.
And he started enlisting the help of some of his associates.
Yes.
And one of these associates, the main associate really, was his little brother, 24-year-old Adrian Peeler, who we talked about at the beginning, and who also, much to his mother's sadness, even after her passing probably, he too followed a life of crime and did not turn out to be a good person and was very happy to help his older brother and role model, really, with whatever he wanted to do.
Yeah.
Another one of the associates that Russell enlisted was 33-year-old Josephine Lee, who, not really an associate. She didn't really, like, work with him. She was more of a client.
Yes, she was more of a frequent purchaser of the crack cocaine.
Yes, she was also a sex worker. Some of the articles I read kind of speculated that that was how she was affording the crack cocaine. She was struggling. She was not living a good life. She was struggling. She basically was in the palm of Russell's hand.
Oh, yeah.
And she, too, lived pretty much right across the street from Karen Clark and BJ Brown. And even if she didn't, she was over at the crack house enough to basically have probably claimed residence there. So, close enough. So, Russell told Josephine, he goes, hey, can you do us a favor? I want you to be out on the lookout for when Karen and BJ get home, and you're going to kind of sound the alarm. Caw-caw, caw-caw, let us know. And she goes, I don't know. Like, he's a young kid. That really bothers me. Mm-hmm. She's never done anything to me. She seems like a great mom. He's a little boy. That's really fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I'll give you a bunch of crack cocaine. She goes, done.
Yeah.
Like, done deal.
Literally. And it's addiction, you know, like it's a sad part of addiction. But once you bring the drugs into it, it doesn't matter anymore.
And she kept saying, she goes, give me the drugs. I want the drugs. You know, I'll help you. But I am not going to be responsible for killing these people. I'm not going to kill them. I'm not going to, like, I'll be the lookout, whatever. But give me the drugs. I'm just letting you know, no way am I going to go in there and shoot them or something like that.
Right, right, right.
So on January 7th, 1999, Karen and sweet little BJ got back to their home from grocery shopping, and they were downstairs. They were actually getting ready to bring their bags upstairs when there was a knock on the door, and Karen, you know, she was getting the groceries together, and okay, BJ, go upstairs, bring this up, honey, put the milk in the fridge, and then the doorbell rang. So she was like, yeah, who is it? And then she heard a woman's voice on the other side of the door, like, oh, I'm so-and-so from across the street. And so she cracked the door open a little bit and saw a woman. And then next thing Karen knew, someone was forcing their way inside and she was being thrown back. Groceries are flying everywhere. 24-year-old Adrian Peeler burst into the door. And this was after Josephine had indeed played lookout.
Yep.
And she saw them get home and coming inside. And her job was to page the Peeler brothers. And as we know, their crack house was right there.
Yeah.
So within 5 minutes, Adrian pulled up.
Yeah.
Not Russell. Russell couldn't do this himself, apparently.
No, of course not.
It was, he put all this on his little brother, Adrian. So Adrian and Josephine walked across the street together, and Josephine was the one who was standing outside the door. Hey, it's me from across the street. Rang the doorbell, knocked, and then Adrian forced his way inside. And per Josephine, Karen started screaming for BJ to run. And they both run upstairs, abandon the groceries, run upstairs as fast as they possibly can. Karen is screaming, BJ, run, honey, run. And Adrian chases him up the stairs. Per Josephine, she's just standing in the doorway watching this.
Yeah.
And Karen ran into a room upstairs that we later find out is the bedroom. And Josephine said that she could see BJ reaching out for his mom and just screaming, mommy, 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 mommy. And then Josephine saw Adrian run into the bedroom where Karen had went, and then she heard a gunshot. And then BJ is still screaming, still reaching out for his mom. Adrian comes out, shoots BJ in the head.
BJ died calling out for his mommy.
And when police went to the home and found, you know, the scene, they found Karen lying face up on the floor of her, it was her son's bedroom, and her hand was reaching out to grab the phone to call for help.
That's the most brutal and awful thing. Just absolutely devastating.
Josephine agreed to testify against Adrian and his brother Russell, and she was placed into the Federal Witness Protection Program. She pleaded guilty in May of 1999 to conspiracy to commit murder, and in exchange for her testimony, prosecutors promised her that they would advocate for a reduced sentence and ask for a sentence of no more than 7 years. A few months later, in December of 1999, Josephine wrote a letter to her lawyer after making the deal with prosecutors, and this letter was described as rambling. Mm. In the letter, she wrote about wanting to do less time in prison and that she was lying about the case. She wrote, quote, "Everything that I have told them is lies. I have to make this thing right, and deep down inside, God knows that I did not have anything to do with the murder. I can't live with myself telling a lie on the peelers."
Hmm.
First of all, for less jail time, you helped an 8-year-old boy and his mother get shot.
Yeah.
For jail time, you get what you get and you don't get upset.
Yeah. I think you, yeah.
You stood in the, you played lookout and you stood in the doorway watching an 8-year-old boy get shot in the head.
Yeah.
You are going away and you, whatever sentence you get, you are going to like it.
Yeah. And I think she got off lightly.
Completely. Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Russell Peeler's lawyer, John Walkley, said that he interpreted the letter as a complete reversal by Josephine, mm-hmm. and that he would try and use the letter to ask that the charges against Russell be dismissed. He stated, quote, "She said she wasn't involved and the Peelers weren't involved. It confirms what I've known all along, that she was never there and that she had been lying about it from day one."
No, she's just insane.
She's fiending.
She's, yeah.
She's in jail and she's like, "I want more crack cocaine.
Yeah.
How do I get out of jail?"
Yeah.
At around the same time she wrote the letter to her lawyer, Josephine wrote letters to 3 Bridgeport police officers that worked the case. In these letters, she wrote, quote, "I know what I did was wrong. I get down on my knees every night and ask God to forgive me for what I have done to the boy and his mother." She also went on to say that she's grateful to be alive, writing, quote, "Thank God that my life is still here because the Peelers did not kill me, and that is a blessing from God."
Mm.
AKA, I helped them. They could have killed me. Mm-hmm. They didn't. I'm grateful to be alive. I'm sorry for my role in the murder of BJ and his mother.
Pretty much, yeah.
It's like PEMDAS. The two cancel each other out.
Like, literally.
You're staying in jail, Josephine. Russell, guilty. Adrian, guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Put down the pen, stare at the wall,
yeah.
Think about what you've done.
Yes, 100%. 100%. That being said, it wasn't super long until Russell and Adrian Peeler were both arrested and charged. On January 14th, 1999, the brothers were finally held responsible for what they did and charged for the murders of Karen Clark and BJ Brown. Adrian Peeler was charged with conspiracy to commit murder, while Russell, specifically, was charged with 1 count of murder and 2 counts of capital felony, which was 1 for the murder of BJ and the 2nd for the double murder, and then 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. And yes, I understand that Russell was not there, and he did not commit the murder. I did not mix that up. He was charged with the murder, while his brother, who did pull the trigger, was not. I know, like, it's crazy, but I wish Adrian was also charged with that, but I'm glad Russell was charged because it was because of him.
100%. And now they're kind of tacking on stuff too for the fact that he murdered Rudy.
Yeah.
And they're also probably like, okay, final straw, we have to get this guy off the streets. Like, he's a major drug lord, he's running shit, and he should not be.
Yep.
Tack him with whatever you can get him on. He's going away for a long time.
Oh, yes. Russell was subsequently found guilty of all charges, thank God. And the sentencing hearing that followed involved seeking the death penalty for the 2 capital felony convictions. The jury in his 2000 trial was deadlocked, actually, on the decision of death penalty. And they really kept going back and forth, like, should he get the death penalty? Should he not? It wasn't even so much so that it was like, ooh, like ethics, you know, like, I don't know, should, is this good or bad, blah, blah, blah. But also, like, did he meet the criteria, et cetera, et cetera. And they just kept getting deadlocked. And so he was eventually just sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. However, in December of 2007, A new hearing was ordered and ultimately found that the mitigating factors in the case, which of course involving the murders of Karen and 8-year-old BJ, did meet the criteria for the death penalty. And so his life imprisonment sentence was changed to a death sentence. Great. So now he was sent to death row, a special unit in a prison in Connecticut where he was sent to death row. And he joined a few other people, like 9. Unfortunately, Connecticut abolished the death penalty, as we've discussed it here a few times, in 2012. So Russell flip-flopped and found his way back in prison with a measly life sentence without the possibility of parole, where he is to this day.
The sentencing hearing where he was sentenced to the death penalty, very, very emotionally charged for members of Karen and BJ's family.
As you can imagine.
And I'm sure that this whole process, I mean, 2007, he's being sentenced. Finally, like, this is the real deal. Go away.
And it was brought up again. Like, he had been charged and, like, sentenced. And then it was like, 7 years later, oh, by the way, let's try this again.
So long, so drawn out.
Yeah.
And Karen's brother, Oswald, at the sentencing hearing where Russell got the death penalty, he stated to the courtroom, quote, he killed my mother. She died 2 years ago. He doesn't deserve any more time. He doesn't deserve to live anymore. My only regret right now is his brother is not here with him. Russell responded to this by shouting, I did nothing to your family. And Oswald shouted back, you need to be quiet. And Russell yelled back, this ain't no show. See you later. So they were going, screaming at each other.
Yeah. Inappropriate from Russell.
And Adrian Peeler, like you said, Liz, was charged with conspiracy to commit murder. He was sentenced to 25 years in prison. That was supposed to be followed by a 35-year federal prison sentence for drug dealing, which riddle me how you get more time for drug dealing than you do for a conspiracy to commit murder, which really was him shooting an 8-year-old boy in the head.
I don't get it.
Riddle me that.
I just don't.
After his sentencing, Russell was put in prison, and in one article I read, the man next to him in the cell over was a young man who was very mentally ill and described as being emotionally troubled. Mm. You know, Russell could hear him talking to himself and, like, pacing and crying, and just, he was very mentally ill and struggling. Russell had to be moved to a different cell because he was caught continuously telling the man to kill himself and trying to convince him to take his own life.
What an evil man.
Sickening. After Karen and BJ's murders, their family members attempted to file a lawsuit against the state of Connecticut for $100 million for their failure to protect BJ, who was obviously killed because he was a star witness in Rudolph's murder case, and Karen, who was killed because, you know, that was her son.
Right.
Former police chief Thomas Sweeney had said previously before the murders that the police department had placed special patrols outside Karen's house, but he said that she asked them to stop the patrols because the presence was intrusive and just very obvious. It was like pointing a huge finger, hey, they live right here.
Yeah.
And there really was not a better solution that was brought into place. The lawsuit was dismissed in 2004 after U.S. District Court Judge Christopher Droney ruled that former police chief Thomas Sweeney and the department did not violate the constitutional rights of BJ and Karen. And he said that while the witness protection efforts of the Bridgeport Police Department failed, it was not a constitutional rights issue, stating, quote, the court leaves to another day and perhaps another court the question of whether the Bridgeport Police Department was negligent in the lack of protection provided to BJ and Karen Clark. The issue here, though, is whether the U.S. Constitution provides a remedy under the circumstances, and it does not. After the murders, the state legislator established a witness protection program and named it after BJ and Karen. Less than a year after he was put on death row, Russell was stabbed with a ballpoint pen by another inmate during an altercation.
Nice.
He was treated at the hospital and was fine. We actually discussed this particular incident in a previous incident.
We did.
This was Daniel Webb.
No fucking way. Episode 2? Holy shit.
Daniel Webb, a menace to society.
Wow.
And he was a menace in prison, too. He was, like, stabbing people left, right, and center. And
yeah.
We talked about this incident literally in our second episode.
Oh?
Yeah.
My God.
Russell Peeler was the one who was stabbed by Daniel Webb. Holy shit.
Little full circle moment there.
Wow. In November of 2021, Adrian's sentence for conspiracy to commit murder was set to expire the next month, and he asked if he could get released early after this expired. His 35-year sentence was to follow for drug dealing, and the judge denied his request for early release, but did reduce the drug dealing sentence to 15 years. So he will be out 15 years from 2021.
Do you the math on your own.
Yeah, that's on you guys. And again, blows my mind that you can go to jail longer for selling crack cocaine than you can for shooting a child and his mother in the head. But
I just don't get
whatever
it.
You crazy.
I just don't get it.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, Russell was on death row and he was with 9 other incarcerated individuals, one of which obviously Daniel Webb and Stephen Hayes, who we covered in past episodes. Stephen Hayes was part of the Cheshire home invasion murders, a horrendous, horrendous case that we covered in our 8th episode, actually. And they are also horrendous individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, before the death row was, you know, abolished in 2012, Russell was the only inmate on death row in Connecticut that did not actually kill the victims that led to his death sentence.
Very interesting. This story broke my heart. A lot of things went wrong here. I don't know how this motherfucker got bail so many times. I don't know how BJ was so unprotected. There's just so much about this that was wrong and devastating. And I feel for his family and her family. And just, it's so sad.
Ugh, and just his little picture, too. Like, genuinely the cutest, sweetest, bubbliest little boy.
Yeah.
And just so uncalled for and evil.
So evil. Well, guys, we always want to know what you think about these cases. This one in particular just has a lot of moving parts, so we're curious to know what you think. You can send us your thoughts and feelings through Instagram. You can DM us. Our account is truecrimene.
All lowercase.
Or you can send us an email at truecrimene@gmail.com.
We also have a website, truecrimene.com. You could go to our contact page and use our handy-dandy submission tool to send us your thoughts, questions, comments, concerns, case suggestions based in New England, please. You can use that tool to be anonymous. You can also, of course, leave your name. If you do leave your name on any of the aforementioned ways to get a hold of us, you can get a little shout-out at the top of the episode. But you can also, of course, be anonymous and... even if you don't reach out to us at all, even if you are just here listening, that is more than we could ever ask for, especially for cases like the one we told you today. It was a bigger case and, you know, of course it was solved, but it's still very important to get out there, especially where one of the victims was an 8-year-old boy who had his life taken from him, and justice maybe, but just a really shitty case, but a very important one to talk about. So we really appreciate you guys being here and listening.
Absolutely. And with that, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Goodbye.